The matter of Friedman versus Martinez. Can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Buckley.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
We'll have you back for rebuttal, perhaps for a little less.
Okay. May it please the court. There are two main issues I expect to address this morning. The first issue addresses whether or not the 30 remaining plaintiffs in this case can meet a prima facie case of invasion of seclusion based upon the available evidence. And the second issue I would address is whether or not my defendants, the owners, managers of the building, had a duty to protect against the third-party conduct of Teodoro Martinez. I'm assuming I'm permitted to address that issue. The petition for certification was granted in full, and we did ask for the full appellate division decision to be considered. So I just saw some looks when I mentioned that issue. So I'll proceed. First, with respect to the issue regarding the intrusion, this court has said in the matter of Frame versus Cathari that drawing lines is the business of the courts, and lines must be drawn to provide remedies for wrongs without exposing wrongdoers to unlimited liability. Said another way, courts draw lines to remedy violations of reasonable care while avoiding the assessment of liability based upon mere conjecture and speculation. Respectfully, I think that's exactly what's happened here with the appellate division decision. It really turns on the crux of, can the plaintiff prove that they were simultaneously in a bathroom within the office building such that there was an invasion upon their seclusion? Respectfully, the evidence doesn't allow them to do so. And respectfully, the evidence does not allow for such an inference to be made. Now, there's a difference between an inference and speculation. An inference is a logical conclusion from a fact, a logical result from a fact going to a conclusion. Speculation requires there's a break in the logic from the fact to the conclusion you seek to reach. There's a leap of logic that's required. And respectfully, based upon the information we have in this case with respect to the cameras, any suggestion that the plaintiffs were in a bathroom at the same time as a camera requires a leap of logic. That's because we only know that the cameras were present with respect to the time that we have on tape. And we know these ladies, the remaining ladies, were not captured on that tape. Otherwise, we don't have evidence as to when the cameras were present, what bathrooms within this five-floor building with two ladies' rooms on each floor. So we don't know when the camera was there. And we also don't know where the camera was. And we don't know the timing of where the camera was. And to simply say, because someone worked there for a long time, means she must have been in the bathroom at a time when a camera was present, that's a leap of logic. One does not necessarily follow from the other. In fact, I would think you could draw an inference the other way, which would say, Since we're not seeing these women on the video that we do have, that it's just as likely that they were never in the same place as a camera in a bathroom. This kind of suggestion by the appellate division to allow this inference as to all the women, basically, who resided or worked in the building could even be expanded. Could be expanded to anybody who visited the building on a regular basis during this time period, was a woman, and used these bathrooms. Taken out to its logical conclusion, the ultimate undoing of the opinion is that there are other situations where the situation becomes much more dramatic. A parkway rest stop, a movie theater bathroom, an amusement park bathroom.
Let's stay with the elements of the tort itself here. Are you arguing or not that a plaintiff has to come forward with proof of a recording in order to establish a prima facie case?
You know, I struggled with that, Judge. And at least for the purposes of this case, I'm arguing that a plaintiff at least has to come forward with proof, with evidence, that she was present in the bathroom at the same time as a camera was present.
And does she have to come forward with a video to demonstrate that? Or is that not required, as you understand the tort of the invasion of privacy here?
I think there are some cases that say you might need to do that.
What's your position?
Unfortunately, I think in our papers, as I was looking at the papers in preparation, I think we said that was not our position. And it's hard to change that at this point in front of your own.
Why are you saying unfortunately? It seems to make a lot of sense. Since people have the ability to destroy videotapes, despite the fact that a camera was in a bathroom. Seems to me that you made a logical concession.
I think perhaps you're right, Judge. But as you start, Justice. But as you start to get ready for these things, you look through.
Let me ask
a question. I'm not sure it's logical. Where do you draw the line at the world of individuals who could sue here? Supposing you said I was there at one of those offices as a customer or a visitor, and I happened to use the bathroom on that day or on some day. Is that person entitled to damages?
I would say respectfully no. It would not be.
So perhaps you don't need to be on the video, but don't you need some proof that at least you were in the time period in question, you were in the bathroom and had the camera, whether you were on the video or not?
That's the position I advance of Justice.
What is the state of the evidence about whether the now fugitive individual who was responsible for putting these cameras erased videotape or however? What is the state of the evidence with respect to video that existed at one time but no longer exists? Is there any evidence on that?
I can only tell you, Justice, that I did see in one of the Somerset County Prosecutor's Office documents a suggestion that it appeared some material had been deleted. Now, it didn't say that it had to be material like this videotape that we're talking about. It was material deleted from his computer. I don't think anybody was able to determine exactly what was deleted.
I want to ask you a question about the summary judgment record that's before us. So we know that there were a class of women who were able to identify themselves in the videos. And they obviously knew what bathrooms they went to during the workday. And we also know that cameras were found in some bathrooms. So my question to you is, of the remaining plaintiffs, do they at any point in a certification, a deposition, or wherever, indicate that they were in any of the bathrooms where the women who were videotaped or were in any of the bathrooms where the camera was found. Are you following me?
I am following you, Justice.
Go ahead.
At least not at the time of the summary judgment motion, which was filed way back in 2014. Now, admittedly, some depositions have taken place since that time, and as I stand here today, I didn't take any of those depositions. I don't know if they gave that testimony or not.
Okay.
But, frankly and respectfully, I don't think that makes a difference for them to say, yes, I used that bathroom where at some point there was a camera in there.
Are there certifications and affidavits at all in the summary judgment record by the plaintiffs?
I don't believe so.
On which the trial court made the decision. I want to be certain about this.
Okay.
And I want you to be clear about this. Well, did any of the plaintiffs indicate that they visited any of the bathrooms in which women who were videotaped said identified bathrooms, or in which a camera was found?
I don't want to mislead you, Justice.
Go ahead.
You justices. I was not involved in the case at the time of that original summary judgment motion. I did not see any such certifications in the record that I have.
Was it just one bathroom or several bathrooms?
More than one bathroom.
More than one bathroom?
Yes.
On several floors? I wasn't sure about that.
Yes.
Well, did somebody give you the entire summary judgment record?
Yes.
And does it have any affidavits or certifications?
Not that
in
it? I saw, Justice.
Would you agree that if one of the plaintiffs said, you see that woman who's videotaped and said she was in the bathroom on the third floor, I was in an office on the third floor, and I went to that same bathroom every day during the 6 months that this person apparently was videotaping. If there was testimony like that, would you concede that that would vault the summary judgment standard?
I don't concede that, Your Honor, simply because we don't know that the camera would have remained in that bathroom by the time this other woman came and used the bathroom. We just don't know that.
Well, this is where you started off by talking about speculation and inferences.
Right.
Under that circumstance, why wouldn't that be a logical inference based upon at least the evidence of record? That woman is photographed in that bathroom during this six-month period. I work on the same floor. I go to that bathroom every single day. Therefore, I had reason to believe that my image must have been captured. Why wouldn't that be a logical inference?
Because I think what we get in a scenario like that is now we're sooner or later, not saying it would be this woman, but if we allow that kind of testimony to bootstrap a claim for invasion of seclusion, what we'll have is people who were never victims of an invasion of seclusion getting that inference and being able to pursue such claims.
But doesn't that answer diminish the mental harm and anguish that comes from knowing a spying device was present in a room that they frequented, and there's evidence that somebody else was captured on that camera during that same period that the person claims to have frequented the room?
You know, Justice, I don't think it minimizes the concern that one might have for a woman who has concerns like that. But there's a counterbalance to that, which is you have to be careful about, even in situations of intentional torts, creating circumstances of unlimited liability where someone could come in and testify, yes, I use that bathroom all the time, but in fact, for whatever reason, by being in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time, they either did or did not.
But
juries make inferential judgments all the time. I mean, there's a footnote in the appellate division decision, footnote 4, that talks about if we go too far in the direction that you're arguing, we essentially have to capture the individual in the act of peeping through a hole and seeing someone or catching the tape while it hasn't been deleted in order to be able to pursue this tort. And it seems to me that points out some of the difficulty with accepting going too far in the direction that you're arguing.
And I understand the point, but again, I just talk about the flip side, where obviously then you have people who are going to make similar, give similar testimony, give similar certifications, who in fact, although we don't know it,
mm-hmm.
If we had a retrospectoscope, we could say that, no, that person was not a victim. She was not in the bathroom at that same time. And I think you have to have lines to prevent that type of liability from being
created. So what are the lines? Just following up on Justice Lavecki's question. What is the principle by which you would differentiate an actionable, a plaintiff who has a cause of action from a plaintiff who has no cause of action based on this admittedly incredibly sparse record with respect to when these cameras were in use?
Right. You know, Justice, I'm sure there are likely circumstances where an inference could be drawn based upon a certain set of facts, but I think it would have to be very particular.
Let's talk about it, because obviously we're talking about a tort that's had almost no law written on it in the state. It's an unusual tort. Let's talk about what would be the minimum prima facie showing to defeat summary judgment. And I understand you're going to say that none of these women, in contrast to the other group, meet that. So I'm not trying to get you off that, because I know that's your position. But what is the dividing line between a prima facie showing and a lack thereof in a summary judgment setting?
I think the dividing line, Justice, would be similar to what we've seen in a lot of the other cases that have been identified. And that is either it's found by someone who is then deemed a victim, or we know that a camera or some other device was present for a certain amount of time. Started in 2003, it's there. It goes to 2007 and is removed in a particular day in 2007. So now we know exactly when that camera is there, and then it's a much easier burden
So in this case, the camera is discovered in November 2009 or thereabouts. Go back to Justice Alvin's hypothetical earlier. An employee who certifies, I worked on the third floor and I went to the bathroom daily during the fall of 2009. Is that a sufficient showing?
No, because this was not a permanent camera. The cameras would come and go, as I understand it.
So what
not a camera that was always in one bathroom.
So what would be needed, short of an actual recording then, in order to make a sufficient showing?
In this case, I suppose if one of these plaintiffs could say, I've looked at the tape, I remember this particular day, I know that my friend is on that tape, I know I was there, I know I was in the bathroom that particular day, that might be enough.
Well, why could they possibly tell what particular day it was from a bathroom?
Well, because...
You're not going to suggest that people remember the clothes they wore every day for 3 years. You don't know when the cameras were there, when they started.
That's true.
You don't know the time period. So how could anybody meet that standard?
That's true. This may be a case where because of the cameras and the fact that they did move around and the fact that we don't have any definitive statement as to when they were in places
this following up on the Chief Justice's question, my earlier one. So long as a plaintiff says, I occupied the place on the third floor, that's the bathroom I went to every day. Okay, I didn't skip a bathroom break. At least once a day I went to the bathroom. And one of the women on that tape said, I was photographed in that bathroom. Why would that be sufficient? That would seem to cover the period when the person definitely would have been in the bathroom when there would have been a camera. You following me?
I am following you, Justice, but again, this is a situation where we have a camera that didn't always stay in one place.
If it just had to stay on that one day when that woman was captured, and you have a plaintiff saying, I visited that bathroom every day while at work. Then it would seem to me that would necessarily encompass that day, no?
I would say no, and I think if you play that out to its logical conclusion, you will then, although maybe you will capture more women who were present when the camera was present, you're also going to start drawing in women who were not present when a camera was present, and now create a tort claim for them when in fact none exists.
I'm going to ask you a question about, and this is a follow-up on Justice LaVecchia's question about that footnote. Assume a motel owner, okay, bores a hole into the women's bathroom, and various women over the course of a couple of weeks find out that there was that hole that permitted this peeping Tom. Is it your position that the women have no claim unless they can show on a particular date that he was actually doing the peeping? Or would each of them have a claim because, as Justice LaVecchia was suggesting, this goes to the peace of mind, the reasonable peace of mind of the victims, that each would have a claim? Go ahead.
I think the cases that I've read, Justice, have suggested that the ability to view surreptitiously, whether by camera or a peephole, the fact that the peephole is there and the fact that a woman, or somebody else for that matter, is in that hotel room, when the peephole is there, there is a cause of action because you've got the ability to do so.
Your point here is that there are two things really missing from the record that would tie, I think this is your point from your brief, that would tie in enough to have an inference. One is that we have contradictory and very sparse information from Martinez. We know cameras came and went, but there, obviously the police had a different objective than a civil litigants when they questioned him, and they did not ask a lot of detailed questions about timing. And secondly, we don't seem to have in this summary judgment record anything tying the 30 women that we're talking, 30 or so women that about whom we are talking here, with the type of things Justice Albin's talking about, which is I was in this particular bathroom, which I recognize from my friend was there and she's in the video or whatever it may be, on a stretch of days that would almost certainly overlap with when a camera was there. I mean, that seems to be the two issues you're raising with respect to this record.
True.
Okay. So if we were to say in a different setting, if there were thorough information from the individual who put the cameras in, whether that's forensic information from the person's computer or testimony with respect to here's when I did it, and you know I worked on these days, and every other day when I worked, or every third day I would do this and keep them in there for a couple of hours, or keep them in there for 24 hours. If you had a thorough record as to when the camera was there, you would be able to draw a pretty sharp line with respect to what the plaintiff's claims would be. Correct?
More evidence would certainly allow a stronger inference.
So if you knew 6 months of basically steady cameras were in that building, you would be able to say that as Justice Albin's talking about with his questioning, if someone said I was there every day and this was the third floor, I worked there, I was in that bathroom every day, that might be enough.
If we had information from Teodoro Martinez or from some other source such as law enforcement that said we've got this from Martinez, or we've established that essentially every day for 6 months, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., that this camera was in that bathroom. And we know that there's a woman who works on the, and, you know, let's call it the west bathroom on the third floor. We know that there's a woman who works on the west side of the building and testifies, yes, that's the bathroom I use at least twice a day. I think then you have a fair inference. But I don't think we have it here.
Tell us what's in the record here. The summary judgment record as it relates to timing. Martinez spoke with law enforcement, with an investigator right after.
Yes.
And set aside the deposition of the detective that takes place after the summary judgment motion. What do we have in the record?
From Mr. Martinez?
Anywhere. In the summary judgment record. What do we have about the timing of the placement of the cameras?
I don't think we have a lot in terms of the timing and placement of the cameras, other than I believe the camera that was discovered was on the third in one of the third floor bathrooms.
Assume that one of the plaintiffs can prove that she was in the bathroom when the camera was there. I take it you're still prepared to proffer a defense. Yes?
Well, Judge, again, I think this is where we started off, where you said I made a good judgment in not insisting that there a video be present. And I'm not going to change that at this point. We did not argue that in our briefs. In fact, we took issue with the appellate division suggesting that we argue
that. So you're
that
conceding
in our briefs.
That if one of the plaintiffs can prove or show, at least at this stage, that she was in a bathroom when there was the camera, she would have vaulted the summary judgment standard.
Begrudgingly, I think I concede that, Justice.
So why would it be appropriate to remand and allow the remaining plaintiffs to make that showing, given the standard that now has been set forth by the APTA?
Because
assume we adopt that standard.
Because the plaintiffs had 3 years prior to the summary judgment motion to come up with all that information, to give certifications as to what bathrooms they used, how often they used those bathrooms, who they went to the bathroom with, and as far as I know, that information was not provided. I think it was more along the lines of you don't need to show a video in order to sustain a claim.
What we've been talking liability essentially here. What is the measure of damages? What must be proven to show damages?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'm not so sure, because it doesn't concern me that much what the measure of damages would be on invasion of seclusion. The measure of damages, as to me, would be for negligent infliction of emotional distress. And frankly, when I started getting ready for this, I spoke to people in my office. I said, hey, let's start getting that motion for summary judgment on, you can't meet the burden of negligent infliction of emotional distress, given the circumstances here.
Could there be damages simply without whether you can prove emotional distress, simply for invasion of privacy? Do you recognize that as a measure of damages? Just the invasion of privacy, whether there is no emotional distress that can be proven through medical testimony?
I think perhaps against Teodoro Martinez there could be, but I don't believe that would flow through to me for failing in a duty to prevent his intentional conduct.
But you're conceding at this point, if they can show that they were, in fact, in a bathroom with a camera, at least at this point, even for premises liability purposes, they would have vaulted the summary judgment standard.
Not if we're including can they prove damages, because I think they cannot prove damages against my client because they'd have to prove negligent infliction of emotional distress,
well, that's
which I
the
don't
reason,
think they
well,
can do.
That's why I asked you whether or not it vaulted, because we have two things going on here. We have two different torts. One is an intentional tort, okay? That's the intrusion into a person's solitude or seclusion. That's an intentional tort. Okay, that's Martinez. That covers Martinez.
Yes.
The question now is what standard applies to the owner of the building? Okay. One is premises liability, negligence. Mm-hmm. I know there was an argument that you would be vicariously liable. You obviously reject that. But at this particular stage, what more would the plaintiffs have to do to vault the premises liability? You had some obligation to take reasonable steps to prevent this filming.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. And that's really the second part of my argument, which is there is no duty ever recognized in New Jersey that would suggest that a commercial building owner and operator had an obligation to take action to prevent a third-party actor from installing surreptitious video equipment.
Is this issue before us? Is this?
You're still talking. Go ahead.
I want to understand what we're supposed to be doing here. So we know that the appellate division decided one issue. It didn't address this premises liability issue.
Correct.
Is that before us?
Well, that's a good question, Justice. When I looked at our brief, we didn't directly touch upon that. However, in our notice of petition, we did challenge the entire appellate division ruling, and petition was granted. So I believe it's in front of
even though there's hardly any argument in front of the court in writing. Even though, as you correctly concede, there's very little in the brief on this issue, you want to make a full-blown presentation to us now?
Well, it's a very brief presentation. There's not much.
Before you make it, we've been talking liability, premise liability. My question was, what is required to prove a quantum of damages? Do you need actual injury, invasion of privacy without anything further, no emotional distress? What is your position? Whether you're liable or not, we've been discussing liability. Let's talk, assuming they get by that on summary judgment for sake of argument, and go to trial. What do they have to prove to a jury to recover damages, in your opinion, based on what the facts we have here?
Against my clients?
Right.
Yeah, I think they, so there's no direct claim, there's no invasion of privacy claim against my client. So it's the premises liability allowing a negligent infliction of emotional distress. And the negligent infliction of emotional distress standard is something where I think the standard is to the extent of it has to be a significant impact on you to the extent you're physically impacted. And I think they're going to have a hard time meeting that standard.
I'm trying to understand. Why wouldn't the premises liability be bootstrapped to the intentional tort? It seems to me that the plaintiff's argument would be, this is their argument at least, through your lack of acting reasonably, okay, not following your duty of due care, you permitted this intentional tort of solitude or seclusion to occur, and therefore whatever damages arise from that intentional tort flow to you if they can prove that you were negligent. Why wouldn't that be the standard?
That's not how the case was pled, as far as I know, Judge.
And premises liability doesn't bring in intentional torts and make you liable for those intentional torts. If you had a premises case where somebody was robbed in the parking lot of an office building, the issue would be whether you used due care to make the property safe, but you wouldn't be liable for the damages from the intentional tort.
If that
occurred.
Yeah,
the standard's different. So take that example in a parking lot where, and we have cases on this, where the supermarket does not provide security and someone winds up getting shot and killed. The damages are the same in the wrongful death case for the premises liability owner, as if the person had actually shot the person, maybe not for punitive damages, but the wrongful death action in terms of the damages would be no different. Am I mistaken?
Well, I think you're judged differently. I forget what the jury, there is a jury charge on that, and I forget exactly what it reads, but I know the jury is allowed to consider the competing culpability of
But the damages, like, whatever the victim suffered, let's say in a case like this, assuming the person was in a bathroom with the camera, they're suffering the same mental anguish, whether or not the plaintiff is Martinez, defendant is Martinez, or the defendant is the owner of the building. What they have suffered doesn't change. You may have different defendants, But the mental suffering isn't the same, and therefore why would the damages be the same?
That may be true, Judge, but that's not how this case was pled.
There's no vicarious liability of your clients for the employee of the security company.
There was a claim for that, but we had that. That was one of the claims that was dismissed by way of, I think it was a February of 2016 summary judgment order.
And that's not before the court?
I don't believe that's before the court, Judge.
Is there anything else you wanted to add on duty? We're beyond the half hour, and I wanted to give you that brief opportunity.
So if we're talking about, since we're on it, if we're talking about whether or not the owner's managers had a duty to prevent what happened here, I'm not going to burden the court with the totality of the circumstances and Clohessy, and if I'm saying that correctly, and how that all applies. But we just don't have anything here, Justice, that would have caused the owner's managers to have a duty to prevent Teodoro Martinez from putting this camera in the bathrooms. We know there's no, the record is clear that there was no heavy criminal activity in the area, either at our facility or in the surrounding areas. We know there was no complaints regarding Teodoro Martinez, we know there was no complaints about weird things going on in the bathrooms. Plaintiffs attempted to create a duty by serving an expert report who identified 43 reported instances of electronic voyeurism from 1995 to 1999. Out of those 43, over 14 years, it comes down to 3 a year across this entire country, only 2 of them might have involved an office building. Couldn't tell for sure if it was a commercial office building or not, but only 2 of them, and only 1 or 2 of them happened in New Jersey. And what happened at the second summary judgment in February of 2016 is that the judge deciding that motion kind of latched on to a clause within a standard Jones-Lang-LaSalle contract that's given out to all contractors who come and work in their building. And this clause is meant to try and keep the workers in certain areas so as to not disrupt the daily activities of the building, so as not to dirty up the bathrooms with guys who have sheetrock all over them washing up at the end of the day in certain bathrooms. So what this clause says, and this is part of the record, all workers shall enter and exit the building through the service entrances only. Okay, so it's telling the workers how they can come in the building. Workers are restricted to certain areas. Again, we're restricting these guys to, or women, to where they're supposed to be. Access to toilet areas will be limited to those specifically approved by Jones-Lang-LaSalle Americas. Now, the trial judge, in my opinion, took the unique interpretation of that last sentence to say that Jones-Lang-LaSalle had to approve specific individuals to be able to use the bathrooms. And that's just not how this entire sentence reads, this clause reads.
Counsel, I'm afraid we're getting pretty deep into the weeds right
okay.
now. Your position is there's no duty for the reasons that you've stated, and we accept that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Mendel.
Essentially scrapping my outline based on the questions that were just asked, I'd like to address some of them. And Justice Patterson, you had inquired about the state of the evidence, and it's virtually non-existent with respect to the remaining plaintiffs. The trial judge, or shall I say the motion judge, repeatedly said, I don't have certifications. I don't have proper opposition to the statement of material facts that were submitted. And that was a big issue that the trial judge had expressed. And part of the trial judge's comments are interesting when you consider what the appellate court then said, because the trial judge on January 24th, 2014, during the arguments on summary judgment, made clear with respect to the ruling, quote, you got to show the camera was in there when you were in there, and you don't have to be videotaped. This invasion of privacy took place when the camera was there, but they can't prove the camera was there, close quote. And I mention that because the appellate division appears to have inadvertently changed what the argument really was and converted it to an argument as to whether you actually have to be shown on an actual video.
So your view, your position is that if they could show that they were in a bathroom at the same time as a camera, whether the camera's working, not working, disconnected, connected, that would get them at least as far as the jury.
No, and I'll tell you why. Because you also wanted to know where we draw the line. And if I respectfully can get to where we draw the line, I will do that if I may. I just want to address some
Please
other
continue.
Questions because, Justice LaVecchia, you had asked what about if I frequented the room, and I submit that is not enough because of what I will say about where we draw the line. Mm-hmm. Frequenting is not enough to get to a jury. Justice Albin, and I know the Chief Justice had also referred to, well, what if I'm in the same bathroom every day and it's the same bathroom that was used by somebody else? And in terms of where we draw the line and something counsel had just said, that is insufficient based on this record because the camera here was not operational every day and all day. And going back to the state of the evidence, what we have from Mr. Martinez, if we accept the confession, is that he did not have a pattern of how he installed the cameras. He said it was during work hours, and he didn't know if it was 6 months or a year, and it doesn't identify from what I know which bathroom, which floor, and we have multiple.
Whether it's operational or not, how is that any different from the peephole when we don't know when the person is doing his voyeuristic lookings?
And I'll get to where you draw the lines, but why does operation matter? Because almost every day, most of us walk into bathrooms while we're texting or doing other things with a camera that is an operational recording device.
I want to know what the difference is between the peephole that isn't being viewed, okay, and the camera which isn't on at a particular moment. What is the distinction between the two?
The distinction is whether it's on or not should not be the litmus test. It should be whether it is an operational recording device.
Do you agree if there is a peephole that a person in a bathroom will have a claim whether or not she can prove at that precise moment the person was actually viewing her through the peephole?
I would consider a peephole tantamount to an operational recording device due to the fact that there could be a person behind that wall who is able to visualize it.
So when a camera is mounted, how is a plaintiff supposed to prove whether it's operational or not? That's an impossibility. In the same way that it's impossible to determine whether or not a person at a particular moment is looking through a peephole.
Because the difference with a camera is there are abilities to show if the camera was an operational camera. And here, by way of example, we have a computer that showed only 8 hours during the entire period of time, which goes back to the state of the evidence in this case. Even if you were to accept that he had recorded for approximately 6 months, and there's only 8 hours depicted on video, and you were to go to an average eight-hour day, a 40-hour work week, statistically, that would show that only 1% of anything was captured during the workday, or alternatively, 99% of the time he was not recording. So if we want to go on the state of the evidence here, the inference would be that he was not recording all day,
every day. That's all they recovered. There could have been materials that were destroyed. There could have been other computers. Who knows? We just don't know.
And that's for the plaintiffs to be able to establish, because also witnesses die.
I understand, but the one thing that they do know is that certain women were captured, okay, on a camera, and I don't know whether or not the record reflects this. If they could show that their client went into the same bathroom every day during the same period, why wouldn't they have a claim?
The critical words were during the same period. And that's what's missing in this case, is we have an admittedly movable camera. You have a USB, is what it's been called in this case. You even have testimony that one of the women had said, I thought that I had located the device. I thought it was a feminine product, and I threw it out, which, for purposes of my client, shows the detectability issue that is so far-fetched in this case. There are in this case, a lack of evidence to get by summary judgment and to get your case in front of a jury. And if you can take it to an extreme, I know there's been examples cited of amusement parks. Look at Newark Airport, where you have 20,000 plus employees and over 40 million people going through. If there was a camera on one day in one of the bathrooms out of many, where do you draw the line? Is it terminal A, B, C?
That's a different issue. I'm trying the state of the evidence and the lines that you're willing to draw are two different things. So let's stick with the lines that you're drawing. If they were able to show that a woman was videoed from a bathroom, say on the third floor, during a particular time, and other plaintiffs said, I used that same bathroom during that same period of time, would they have a claim?
Yes.
Okay.
And the factors that I would think would draw the line, and that is different than the facts here, but there must be, and I say this because the times have changed since all of these cases that have been cited from around the country from years ago. Recording devices have changed. We all walk around with them, and the fear is that the court's decision can open up the floodgates to litigation.
You're saying your cell phone analogy is you're saying that if there's a cause of action for being maybe or possibly in the same room as a recording device with no proof that the recording device was operational or recording, that almost anybody at any moment in a public bathroom could have a cause of action for the potential mental anguish of possibly being recorded.
I did it last night when I went to the locker room in the gym, and I took my phone from my jacket and I put it in my pocket so I could listen to music through my headphones. There are people changing in that locker room. I don't just have a recordable device. I have a very good iPhone that takes very good pictures had I wanted to do
that. You might
want to
get counsel right now to see if you should make any of this.
But think about it. I have met the elements that some courts say satisfy an invasion of privacy.
But we're not dealing with that. So I'm going to help you out with your defense. Okay?
I'll call myself the hypothetical person.
We're dealing here with cameras that are mounted that have no purpose other than to capture people going into the bathroom. We're not talking about a person with a cell phone listening to music with the cell phone in his pocket. Big difference, yes?
Definitely, and that's why there's elements I'd propose to the court. And I think that you would have to show there's an active operational recording device. If it's not plugged into anywhere or cannot transmit, that's a factor this court should consider. Is it an active operational device?
That's not an issue here, though.
Well, here the problem is you have people who said they found a USB. You have an object that was moving. So what I just present to the court is that is an element that if this court is going to set forth elements on how many people can start running to court because they may or may not have been in a bathroom when there's several bathrooms and they may or may not have been on the floor, they may or may not have been in the building, and if they were, they may have worked, they were visited. There's too many unknowns, and I would just submit to this court that you also need to show that you were in the presence of that active operational recording device and that your image is within the recordable zone.
So I want to understand what your meaning of operational, that it was an actually good recorder, but it wasn't on. They'd have to prove when it was on and when it wasn't on?
No. That it had the ability to record. If I put a picture of a camera on the wall, that would not meet the elements.
Okay, so as long as the recorder is on the wall and it has the ability to operate, even if it's off, the plaintiff would have a claim.
That would be an operational recording device. And what you would need to show is that device even able to record you? And this is lacking in this case, but in 99% of the cases, you will have the ability to demonstrate this as a plaintiff. This is a unique case.
There's really nobody, it's nobody's fault that there is a very sparse record of a criminal investigation and a long gone individual here who's the defendant technically in the case but is never going to be heard from again.
Right.
This is, your point is there is an unusual lack of evidence here that will not be. In most cases, the person will be deposed. There'll be a much more thorough examination of what they were doing, and so forth.
No fault of the plaintiffs, no fault of anyone. What you're saying is directly on point. And my argument is, this is an easy case as we see it in terms of granting summary judgment, but what are the implications depending on how far this court goes on recognizing the right and how far the right goes to maintain a cause of action? So another thing I would just submit to the court, that you need one of two other things: a surreptitious recording device, meaning you meant to hide it, or it's in the open and you were captured. I'm just looking for things that this court, I hope, will take under advisement so that the average person with a cell phone who's texting or on the phone when they enter a bathroom or a locker room is shielded from even having to defend a lawsuit. And that's what's important. And if you have those factors, it shows how far removed my client would be as simply being a security company.
Go back to your third factor for a minute and just explain that on a factual level.
I'm sorry.
Image within the recordable zone.
Okay, within a recordable zone, because yes, you can have, and the peephole example is interesting as well, because it needs to be a peephole that there needs to be some inference that it was used for peeping, because a landlord who takes a picture off a wall and pulls out the nail has in essence created the equivalent of a peephole. So there needs to be some reason behind this, that it was a peephole for the purpose of being able to view what's inside the room from a hidden location. Otherwise, every time you forget to spackle your wall, you're creating a cause of action, which is why it's very important that we are very careful.
So the hypothetical earlier about a woman saying, I use this bathroom on a regular basis at around the same time somebody else was captured, they'd have to pinpoint the stall and the ambit of what the camera could record as well under your factors, no?
Well, one of the issues is, where does that zone of privacy first begin? And plenty of courts
But that has nothing. That has nothing to do with the recording device. The zone of privacy is the location where you are, like a bathroom in this case. If the person who's in the bathroom and there's a camera and sees the camera, does it matter whether it's able to record or not to that person? It's intruding into their privacy just by the mere fact that they see something that could record them. Does it have to be a camera that can actually record in order for the tort to exist?
Yes, because it would be an unfounded accusation each time you see a hole in a wall or
we're
an
talking camera
towel.
Now, not talking hole in the wall.
If you're
the peephole guy.
It would be almost an attempted intrusion upon your seclusion.
There's no such story as attempted or defense to that. If you're in an area of privacy and you see a recording device, whether it's able to record or not, does that impact the actual tort, your invasion of your seclusion?
When you're able to discern that it's not, in fact, able to record through
any reasonable... How would you know that unless you actually went up, took the camera, took it apart? Isn't the fact that you see a camera that could record you if it was working, isn't it sufficient?
I think it's a tough thing to answer. I'll be perfectly candid with you. Can that, in many people, create some psyche of, I'm now terrified? However, there needs, I submit, to be some showing through yourself, a police investigation, or your attorney, that was a founded fear that you generated.
Wouldn't that go to my earlier question, that the difference between liability and damages, and every negligence or personal injury case, there's question of liability, question of damages. Put simply, in an automobile accident, for example, if you rear-end someone, there's 100% liability, but if they weren't injured, there are no damages. On the other hand, if you hurt somebody badly, but they ran the red light, there's no liability. So in a situation such as this, the camera, whether it's recorded or not, would that violate the seclusion, intrusion and seclusion tort? And then the question is, are there reasonable damages because the camera wasn't recorded? You're not on anyone's picture, nothing has been shown. So wouldn't that go to the damages part, not the liability part?
And courts throughout the country, and they've been cited in the briefs, make that distinction. And I would still submit to you that if it was not able to record, then is it reasonable for somebody under those circumstances to maintain a cause of action and say that they were psychologically harmed when they've then learned that it did not record? And again, this case is very unique because there is no evidence in this record that it was recording nonstop. And frankly, it's to the contrary. And the motion judge, you know, several times lamented about the lack of evidence that was before the court.
Tell us why a remand would not be appropriate. I assume you're going to say they had their ability to do this before the trial court, and you don't get a do-over when summary judgment's granted.
And try to bring your argument to a close, because I know you asked for 5 minutes. We've covered
Chief Justice, I'm always happy to sit back down.
After you answer.
Justice Patterson, the remand does nothing because there were years from which to obtain discovery, and it was not produced for purposes of the summary judgment. And we know that when you do try to oppose summary judgment based on saying that there needs to be additional discovery, you need to identify specifically what that additional discovery will be. We have already, the attorneys in the record said, whether, you know, the admissibility is another issue, that they reviewed the confession tape. My understanding is there's nothing more that's going to be produced. And when you've had sufficient time and you can't identify anything other than maybes, maybe this will appear, for purposes of summary judgment, the time is up.
There was a colloquy specifically about where are the certifications before the trial court, correct?
Definitely. And the motion judge took issue, but yet, even on a motion for reconsideration, when stuff was submitted out of time, and this is, the motion judge added an additional three plaintiffs who had previously been dismissed. Even at that stage, the motion judge was willing to accept new evidence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Justice.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. May it please the court. What we have here is a simple case of application of the summary judgment standard, and that's whether there was sufficient evidence from which a jury could find that the privacy of these women, 30 women, had been invaded. The trial judge, who ruled on the motion initially, found that determined that they needed direct evidence that would be the only sufficient proof of an invasion of privacy, that their images must have been captured on the video in order to have sufficient evidence to prove that their privacy was invaded. That is simply not the standard, as the appellate division recognized. There's circumstantial evidence from which you can prove an invasion of privacy, and that's what the appellate division found.
Was the appellate division creating a straw man there by talking about a standard that was stricter than what the trial court actually applied?
No, Judge. Justice, I was, I was at the oral argument on the summary judgment motion. The court's ruling was clear that he was looking for identification on the video as the determinative factor in allowing the causes of action to go forward. That's why 30 of the women were allowed to proceed with their cases, while the 30 who could not identify themselves on the video were dismissed.
You've heard the questions I've asked. So, in the record, in 2014, did any of your clients say that, I've looked at the recording, those people who said that they were on the third or fourth floor bathroom, I was on the third or fourth floor, and I attended that bathroom every day during the same period. Any evidence of that type?
At the time of the summary judgment motion,
yes.
No. The plaintiffs had not been deposed at that time.
You could have filed certifications.
Like
what evidence did you present that would have placed one of your clients in one of the bathrooms where there would have putatively been a camera?
Well, quite frankly, that wasn't the issue that was being argued. The issue that was being argued was whether it was necessary to have the images of the women captured on the video in order for them to sustain a cause of action. Our understanding, the Solomon case had just come out at that time, and our understanding was that whether or not they were having captured on the video was totally irrelevant to whether they could maintain a cause of action, because the plaintiffs in Solomon certainly weren't captured on the video and the appellate division.
But do you agree that you had a place, in order to survive summary judgment, you had to place one of your clients in a bathroom where there was a camera? Did you do that?
We did not, at that time, we did not do that, no. Since then, because this case had been remanded by the appellate division, discovery had continued, and every one of the clients has been deposed, and every one of them has said, I worked at this building, I used the same restrooms that the cameras were found in, I use these restrooms every day, twice, three, four, five, six, some as many as seven times a day, and you know that's the testimony that's in the record today.
But the court really went at, I think it was you, were you arguing it, or was somebody else arguing on behalf of the
court? I believe I argued that one.
Okay. The court really directly addressed where are the certifications. I mean, you did have an obligation to make a factual showing to avoid summary judgment, didn't you?
I'm trying to remember the details of the argument. I think that what had happened was that the court had directed that the plaintiffs identify where on the videos that they appeared, and that we had half of our plaintiffs who were able to identify themselves on the videos, and half who weren't. Now, as far as the videotapes go, there's a lot of images on the video that were unclear, and you couldn't tell who it was.
Can I quote to you part of the trial court? Because I want to make certain that the trial court is being dealt with fairly here. And this is part of what the trial court said. And tell me if I'm mistaken. You got to establish a wrongful act. The wrongful act has got to be more than the mere placement of camera. You got to show the camera was in there when you were in there. And you don't have to be videotaped. The invasion of privacy took place when the camera was there. But they can't prove the camera was there. And then the court stressed that agree with if, in fact, they could show that the camera was there. If they weren't on the camera, if they would show that the camera was there on March 17th and they were in the bathroom on March 17th, they at least have something they can bring to the jury. So it seems from the part that I've just read that the court was open to the argument that if you can prove evidence, if you can present evidence, one of your clients was in a bathroom where there was a camera, even if your client wasn't videotaped, you're okay. You'll be able to survive summary judgment. And court seems to be suggesting, well, you haven't done that. So what do you expect me to do?
We had, because at the time that motion was set up, the only issue that the court was interested in was whether the women had been captured on videotape. Now, subsequent to that motion being made and argued.
But I just read to you what the court said.
During the colloquy.
Yeah.
Yes. But the opinion that he issued subsequently had absolutely nothing to do with that. He didn't make any reference to that. He solely focused on whether the women had been captured on videotape, and the fact that their images were not on videotape to him meant that there was no evidence from which a jury could find that they had been that their privacy had been invaded.
So is it a little more nuanced than that? And I'm looking at the record of the oral argument as well. The judge says, referring to the record, the only evidence available in the absence of Mr. Martinez's testimony as to the placement of the device and the time frame is the video recording. And they're not in that recording. There's just nothing in the record I can hang my hat on. Isn't that slightly different than what you're presenting to us?
Well, I think it was undisputed that all the women worked at the office building and all the women used the restrooms at the office building.
Was that in the record? Where they worked and the timing and
Not in that detail.
What was there? Was there anything even, at least it seems to me the defendant was taking the position that the summary judgment record was so sparse that there wasn't even proof that these people actually did work in the building.
There had been answers to interrogatories, certainly, that had been served by that time.
Did the court receive those answers to interrogatories? The fact that they were served doesn't help the court if the court doesn't have.
No, but the defendants didn't make any showing or any argument that the women didn't work there. All of these women, in fact, did work at the building.
Where's that on the record?
I thought some of the remaining plaintiffs, the Ardent plaintiffs, did not, in fact, work in the building, but had been in the building.
No, all of them were employees.
Were actually employees,
building.
The remaining plaintiffs?
Yes. All of them were business invitees on the premises. They all were
not there. What I asked.
I'm sorry.
You said employed at the building.
They were
so they
would have
been there repeatedly over time. I thought some of the Arendt plaintiffs, who are the remaining plaintiffs in this case, because all the Friedman plaintiffs are out, they settled.
Right.
And by the way, that settlement was before the summary judgment motion was decided?
No, that was several years after summary judgment.
Okay. So evidence was accumulated. The plaintiffs, the Friedman plaintiffs, who had themselves on video, I guess, most of them, settled out. The Arendt plaintiffs are remaining. And I thought that of that group, they may have been business invitees, they might have been there in business, they might have been clients, they might have been something, but some of them were not even employees at the building.
Now, it's my understanding that they were all employees
okay.
at the building.
I'm just
let me ask you, the Appellate Division has an extremely general statement of what is required. And this is page 95 of the opinion. The reasonable inference should have been applied to any plaintiff who could assert her use of the facilities during the same general time frame other plaintiffs were spied upon. So let's talk about, as Justice Solomon's talking about, people who were stopped by the building for whatever reason. And let's say somebody says, I don't work in the building. I was in there in 2009. I needed to use a restroom. I figure they wouldn't even notice me walking in there. It was 2009, and now I find this out. Do they have a cause of action?
I would say probably not, because the standard is, can you show that more likely than not, they used the restroom when a recording device was present.
Okay, and that's the standard. You have to defeat summary judgment, have a prima facie case that is more likely than not that the moment the person was in the restroom that they were there with a camera.
Right.
But why is that person in any different position than the employees of the building based on this, and it's not your issue, it's not your fault, it's not their fault, it's not defendant's fault, this incredibly mysterious timing of these cameras. No one knows, realistically, nobody can make any inference as to how long they were there, when they were put there, whether they were there for 10 minutes or hours or whatever. There really is no information. So why is that hypothetical person who stopped by the office maybe one day in 2009 in any different position than employees with respect to their ability to prove they were there at the same time as a camera?
Well, I suppose if they could prove that they were there on the same day that a camera was present in the restroom, that they would in fact have a cause of action. But you know, the casual user of the restroom is not what we're talking about in this case. Since remand, it's now established that it's a virtual mathematical certainty that every one of these women used the restroom while there was a camera present in there. Every one of these women testified that they used the restroom every single day, multiple times in the day.
What if defendant's right that only one, let's just say the defendant's right that only 1% of the time during work days there was a camera present? How does that get you over 50% in terms of preponderance?
I think that the math on that is kind of wrong.
All right, but let's say it is. Let's say they say it's 1%.
Then it's if they're willing to admit that it's that much, then it's a jury question. Is there can a jury find that the plaintiff was had her privacy invaded in the restroom? If there's some evidence to show now the jury might find, well, that's not really sufficient, or maybe they'll find that, yes, 1% of the time that she was in the restroom, every time that she was in the restroom, she was being viewed or in the presence of a camera. That's still an intrusion on the seclusion of the plaintiff. So, it's still a violation.
We have this standard now that Justice Patterson was quoting from. Assume we were to go back and apply that to the record that existed at the time of the summary judgment motion, without certifications and so on. Can you prevail?
I think so, because I think that the the one of the things that we argued at summary judgment was that the motion for summary judgment was premature, and that the standard did not include a finding of an image on the recorded video. We had not had the opportunity at that time to take Detective Taylor's deposition. Ordell Taylor had done the investigation for the Franklin Township Police. Discovery had been delayed repeatedly in this action through the introduction of additional third-party defendants by the primary defendants in this case. So every time they brought in a new defendant, discovery came to a standstill while the new defendants got up to speed, and it took literally years for these defendants to be brought into the case, up to speed, and then get out of the case on their own motions for summary judgment. So it's not like, you know, there was no discovery going on during this period. It's not like, you know, we were in some way delaying the progress of the case. There's only just only so many depositions and so many motions you can make, you know,
except
during
that the trial court said, give me certifications that establish this low, relatively low bar. They were in the bathroom when there was a camera. And everybody's got Taylor's dep. You attached it, they attached it. We got his dep. As far as I could tell, it says nothing about what you're required to prove. Why is not the summary judgment record for our purposes complete? And what evidence is there that overcomes that threshold question? Were they in the bathroom when the camera was there?
Well, to the extent that they were, to the extent that all, that the 30 other women in the case who were
what
not...
What 30 others? The Freedman women?
The Freedman plaintiffs.
Who have all settled. They're not here anymore.
Right.
They were on video.
They were in the case at the time, though, at the time the summary judgment.
Okay, they're gone. They're not here. They're not an issue. We don't care what they show on video.
Except to the extent that that those videos demonstrate that the camera was in operation.
Who says they were in that bathroom at that time among the remaining plaintiffs? In a certification, in a deposition, I know it doesn't say in Taylor's deposition, in a deposition or anything that was before the trial court when they decided summary judgment. What says that?
There is nothing.
When did this remand occur where this additional evidence that you'd like us to consider, when was that developed? Was it after the appellate division decision?
Following the appellate division reinstatement of the case, yes.
You see the issue there in terms of the fairness of summary judgment. I mean, obviously, if you have a summary judgment record that goes before the trial court, generally, unless there's an issue that hasn't been covered or some special reason, you don't get to say, well, wait a minute, if I knew how it was going to play out, I would have put some additional things in.
Right.
And the defendants are saying, well, that's not the record that should be considered here. We should be looking at the original record.
And at the time we made a motion for reconsideration to bring in the new evidence, and we made a motion to sever the case.
That's on reconsideration, the court actually considered some new evidence, right?
Right.
But not certifications from your clients.
Right.
And you're saying now, in light of this additional discovery on remand since summary judgment, there is evidence that some of the remaining plaintiffs, the Arendt plaintiffs, have given evidence, deposition testimony, certification, something that says they were in the bathroom when the camera was there.
Yes, all of them.
And that exists.
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to present?
I would just like to point out, with respect to the owner and manager's duty argument, that was not briefed in their petition. It was not in the question that was certified by this court. It's not really an issue that's in front of this court. If you would like to address it, however, I'm happy to talk about it. The case that we brought against the owner's managers is not a negligent infliction of emotional distress case. It is a premises liability case. They failed to take reasonable steps and make reasonable inspections of the property to keep it safe for the invitees in the commercial building. That's really all it's about. It's a straightforward case. They failed to do anything to maintain the safety of the building. And presumably, had they conducted regular inspections of the building, they would have at least had the opportunity to discover the presence of these cameras in the women's restroom.
So your position is the owner of a commercial building has the duty to regularly inspect the bathroom to see whether or not someone has replace the camera?
They have. I think it doesn't have to be that specific. The owners of the building, of a commercial building, have a duty to inspect the property for any kind of hazards that might pose a safety threat to the people who are coming on the premises.
Well, that's the general standard, but in all kinds of premises liability, whether there's something spilled on the floor, or there's, you know, a defect, somebody just mopped, there's a stairs that are broken, you get into the specific duty as to what the premises owner has to do. So don't you have to be essentially saying there should be regular inspections of bathrooms for cameras?
There's regular inspection of bathrooms for all kinds of things, for broken fixtures, for leaks.
Okay.
For power issues.
Okay.
You know.
So aren't you saying to win on that claim, don't you have to have a court adopt a duty to do regular inspections for cameras?
I don't think it has to be that specific. Had they been performing inspections for anything at all, they would have reasonably seen the cameras at some point over the 6 months to a year that they were being placed in the women's restrooms. But in fact, they weren't doing any inspections at all, except when the owners came around, and then they would go around and clean up the building and patch holes
in the
wall.
What do the cameras look like? Because we know through technology, cameras can be very, very small. These cameras, can you physically describe them to us?
Sure. They consist of a lens on a cord attached to a USB drive, and probably about that long. As Martinez was...
when you say that long, just... we're talking about like a 6-inch camera?
Eight inches long.
And how big is the camera in terms of inches or smaller?
From the photographs I've seen, it looks like it's the lens itself is pretty small, maybe about a half an inch or so. But the point is, the plaintiffs in this case were the ones who discovered the camera because it was hanging out of the ceiling in plain view. The plaintiffs in this case had discovered similar devices earlier, mistook them for trash or used feminine products and simply threw them out.
May I interrupt you?
Surely.
I take it you began with what you thought was your strongest position, and that is that this is not before the court and that this is perhaps not the ideal way to argue a question of duty with counsel standing on their feet and going at it in the manner that we are?
That's correct.
All right. Why don't we stay with the first argument for now, and then we'll ask for more if we want more on this point. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's it. Yeah.
Thank you. We'll hear next from C.J. Griffin.
Good morning. May it please the court. I want to preface my comments with two brief statements. And the first is that I probably know less about the record than anyone in the room. As a friend of the court, I haven't seen the full summary judgment record. I've read some of the briefs, but not all of the briefs. So I'm going to generally be talking in not case specific, but what we believe the court should consider in hopefully affirming the appellate division's decision. Or at least its reasoning. And I also want to preface my comments by saying all of the women in this case, whether they found their images on the videos or not, are legitimate and feeling very violated and victimized and embarrassed and humiliated. And I think it's important that we keep that in mind as we discuss what the legal standards are. Towards the end of plaintiff's presentation, I think the magical words came up. Which I had been thinking throughout the other earlier presentations, which is the preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. And I think that those are the magic words to survive summary judgment. And the standard that both the trial court and the defendants are advocating for really requires concrete proof that you absolutely were there when a camera was there. But all you really need to prove, and you don't need direct evidence of it, circumstantial evidence is sufficient, and reasonable inferences are sufficient, is that it's more likely than not that you were there when a camera was there. And I think based on this record, or a case with similar records, assuming facts were properly put into the summary judgment record, that the appellate division is correct in saying that the circumstantial evidence would be sufficient, that if there is a case where there's a movable camera, and we know that it's present in a bathroom over the course of 6 to 12 months because the defendant stated such, and that we know that women either certify or testify that that's the bathroom that they use, and they use it probably every day, probably more than once a day, that should be sufficient to meet that preponderance of evidence standard and survive summary judgment.
Does a woman have, or a plaintiff have, a cause of action if there is an incident involving someone who works in the building where they were, for example, caught putting up a camera, or everybody knows that it was a very minute amount of time and that person was caught, but that individual says, I'm stunned that this will go on in my office building, and I do not feel comfortable in my building anymore. There's no question that an end was put to it quickly, but does that person have a cause of action?
Let me make sure I'm understanding your question. That she knows there was a camera there. It was very brief.
Right.
She does.
She wasn't. She. There's no indication that she knows that there was a. There was. That she was present while the camera was operating. But she is understandably upset that this could happen in her building where she works, where she's always been comfortable.
I don't know that I can answer that question. I don't think it falls within this particular tort. It might fall within another tort. I don't think it meets the elements. I do think that that's not the case here, that what we know from from all of the evidence and the circumstances is that this was a camera that was there multiple times likely over and easily movable over the course of 6 to 12 months that it recorded.
Let me ask you. Based on amicus, so I'm going to talk about the facts of this case in particular, but with the comment you made earlier and then just in follow-up to Justice Patterson, is it your position that these type of situations are strict liability, that if the camera's there, then there's absolute proof of damages? There's no need to prove any individual damages by any of the plaintiffs? When you said earlier that all the women here, but we're not talking about this case, I'm talking about in general.
In general, I think...
Is it your position a strict liability?
Yeah, I think that it's enough for
you. That's a damage. It's not a...
As to damages, because I'm not able to land on the other issues. As to damages, I think the tort recognizes that it's just the invasion of the mental state and your privacy. You don't need to put forth a plaintiff's expert to show that you suffered extreme emotional distress that's permanent and going to affect you. Perhaps if you did put forth that type of expert, then your damages might be more. But I think much like an LAD claim where you're able to say that you were humiliated and embarrassed and stigmatized by racist comments, that's the type of standard that to prove damages in this sort of case.
And who should be liable? I mean, obviously, you have someone who commits an intentional tort, and the law has always been very cautious about imputing liability to individuals, whether they're the supervisor, the employer, for the intentional acts of others, especially when there's no history that would give rise to foreseeability that this particular employee could potentially pose a threat. So who's liable here?
Well, so liability, I think, is more difficult for me to weigh in on, and I think that Chief Justice and Plaintiff's Counsel were correct that the issue is not that really before the court, and it's not wise for attorneys thinking on their feet to try to resolve that issue for the court. I think the usual standards for premises liability and vicarious liability and respondeat superior would come into play in terms of not only foreseeableness, but general standards of care. I think that the appellate division took the right track here, that it wasn't really briefed there, and it's certainly not briefed here. Put the plaintiffs back in time before that motion on that question came up. Let them argue it again or let the trial court reconsider its prior decision on that issue. we're here because we want to advocate for a standard that was not as victimizing as the standard that ended up happening in this case. So we, as I said, we think that the circumstantial evidence and the reasonable inferences are sufficient if a woman testifies that she used the bathroom during the time frame when the cameras were in and out of the bathroom, and it was that particular bathroom that she utilized. We don't think that a standard that requires women to watch videos is a good standard. Not only is it traumatizing for those women to try to review the videos to try to meet their burden of proof, but for the women that are on the videos, they have repeatedly had their privacy violated by each of these viewings.
How are they going to prove they were in the bathroom, the same bathroom where there was the camera? It would seem to me, in this case, one of the means by which the plaintiff can meet its proof is to look at a video of a person who said she was, maybe she doesn't have to look at the video, as long as there's evidence that that person in the video is claiming that she visited the third floor bathroom in a particular location, then I guess the plaintiffs just have to indicate during the same period visited the same bathroom.
Correct. There could, okay. If it's unknown which bathroom it was, I suppose it could come to a case where there needed to be some way to tell which bathroom it is. But in a case where you know it's bathroom, second floor bathroom right and third floor bathroom left, I don't think that they need to watch the videos. They can say that's the bathroom I use. I generally use the bathroom once in the morning and once in the afternoon or at lunch break. We think that's sufficient. And it's bad enough that the women who are on the tape know for certain that Martinez likely watched them use the bathroom. And then every single time any other plaintiff reviewed the videos, it was another privacy violation. Mm-hmm. And we don't think that the standard of proof should require those privacy violations to occur.
Do you agree with Mr. Mandel's suggestion that the zone of the surreptitious recording matters here? We have to know the angle of the camera's view, for example? I think that's what he meant.
No. I think it was inside the bathroom stall, so mm-hmm. we know that, and we know there's undeniably a zone of privacy, expectation of privacy within a bathroom stall, so I don't think that we need to know what particular angle within the bathroom stall was. Mm-hmm. Just a comment I picked up in the briefing was that it did record genitals. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's anyone suggesting that what took place here didn't violate at least the privacy of the women.
And do you agree that it has to be an operational camera?
No. The cases on this vary. So there are some cases that said, and I think the Solomon versus Kushner case is one of them, that the fact that it was ever operational at any point was sufficient to overcome summary judgment and then mm-hmm. let the jury decide whether they want to believe the defendant that, hey, mm-hmm. I just happened to put a non-functional camera in there, but I promise I never recorded anyone. Okay. I know there's this insistence on proving exactly when the camera was there and exactly when the women were in the room, but the problem with that is that the court would essentially be creating a standard that said, well, it's in the year 2020 because when cameras are moving, there's really no way to prove liability unless there's a static camera. And I don't think that is the correct standard here. So,
and does your view of where the lines get drawn in stating this cause of action account for the fact that there can be recording over as the cameras moved around and nevertheless recording is still occurring,
yeah,
but may not be provable by a particular plaintiff?
Of course. I mean, and actually many video cameras don't record anymore. They mm-hmm. live stream. So you might be showing up on someone's Facebook Live, mm-hmm. Which would be horrendous, but there would be, you know, perhaps in that case it might be archived, but you might be live streamed over the internet and someone might have watched it and deleted it, or maybe it never ever recorded. And so yes, the standard that the court adopts has to reflect what the modern world is and the way that perpetrators are using modern technology to.
Which brings in cell phones. Mr. Mandel made some points about cell phones. And so let's say somebody says when they were in the bathroom, some person took out a cell phone and videotaped them. And that's the allegation. What has to be proven in that case?
So if I'm in a bathroom and I'm in a bathroom stall and I see someone hold their camera.
Or they're in the bathroom, whatever. They're
I think
in.
If you're in somewhere where you have an expectation of privacy, I'm not prepared to determine what portion of the bathroom that would be or what types of spaces. If you're somewhere where you have an expectation of privacy, undoubtedly you do in this case in a bathroom stall, and you see someone holding their device at you in a way that looks like it's recording, then yes, I think you've survived summary judgment, and the jury can hear the question of, hear the defendant's side, like, no, I was just pointing a camera at you, but I wasn't recording, and then they can make the fact determination. If the suggestion is just that there's a liability because we're all carrying phones in our pocket, I don't think that that's not at all what's at issue here. Here we have a case where we know the person was actually doing what it's alleged he did because there's videotape footage of it.
If there's proof through one of the women who was able to review the videotape that she was captured on a particular day, let's say January 2nd, can a judge or jury infer, therefore, the camera was probably there on January 1st and January 3rd? You following me?
Yeah, I think in this case where there's testimony that it was there for a long period of time, not that it was just placed one day out of a whole year, then I think it's reasonable to infer that let the jury decide, is it more probable than not, likely than not, that you were in the camera, in the bathroom at the time a camera was there.
And that it was in a particular bathroom on more than just one day.
Correct, yes.
Even though it's impossible to know how many days.
It is impossible to know how many days, but part of the purpose of the tort is, and I think that's where your comments about mental anguish, Justice Lubecki, are important.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the purpose of the tort is to protect you from the feelings of having your privacy violated. So all of these women feel like it was more likely than not that they were in a bathroom when this camera was there. And they're all suffering the same feelings of being victimized, that whether or not they found their images on the tape or not. And I think it's important to note that there's images they weren't able to identify, so it is likely that more than just the women that have found their images are also recorded. So we just want the court to adopt a standard that takes into consideration modern technology and that not everything is on video evidence, that video evidence is recorded over, that some things are live streamed, and also that doesn't require women to sift through videos of other women having their privacy violated and re-victimize them.
Well, what evidence comes in really has to be handled case by case. I mean, I don't think you're asking us to make a pronouncement that women should never be required to look at videos of other women to see if they're on the cameras, are you?
No, but I think that generally you shouldn't have to do that. If there's other circumstantial evidence in the record, that should be sufficient to survive summary judgment. The direct evidence isn't needed. Although
in this case there were unidentified women.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose the only way one would know whether or not you're one of the unidentified women would be, unfortunately, to have a look at the video, no?
Well, what I'm saying is that could be one way. If there's unidentified women, that could be one way. But you don't need to because of the tremendous amount of circumstantial evidence that and the inferences that you're entitled to under the preponderance of the evidence standard.
But we really don't have that evidence in this case.
Well,
respectfully.
I think that's...
We have in this case, I mean, you can say 6 months or a year, but there is nothing tying down. It doesn't really help anybody. There's nothing tying down whether this happened briefly or happened over months or whatever because of this unique dearth of evidence that we have here. So to say that there's so much evidence out there that you don't need to have the women look at the videos, that may apply in some case. But here we just have no idea how long this was going
on.
Well,
I think that's one reason. I think that there are failures in the record in terms of not putting forth certifications by the women and that sort of thing. But one reason where I think there's a major error in the trial court's decision is granting summary judgment before discovery was complete, especially knowing that, for example, the subsequent deposition of the detective about Martinez saying the cameras were there for 6 to 12 months, that's important information that would have helped them survive summary judgment and would have helped them meet that standard I'm talking about. Martinez's confession could be relevant. Other documents in the file could be relevant. And so
the confession went in. The confession was before the court, wasn't it?
I don't, my understanding is no, but like I said, I don't know the
maybe
record.
You're right. I thought it was.
As well as the parties do. But there was it appears that there was the county prosecutor's file that they were still working on getting, and that sort of thing. So I think summary judgment was premature, and it would have brought forth some of these, you know, facts that I'm raising. But what's important to us is if it is not the particular outcome of this case, but of cases like this case, and so mm-hmm. that the court makes it clear in future cases where there's movable cameras and where women can testify that they use that particular facility on a daily basis, that that would meet the standard without having to prove video camera footage recorded you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Buckley, do you want to offer a vote?
Yes.
May I ask one question, and if you could come to the center, could you respond to the arguments from Mr. Solomon that summary judgment was premature?
Well, summary judgment was entered after 3 years of litigation, and the plaintiffs had all the facts that they needed to try and avoid summary judgment, as has been alluded to. They certainly could have offered certifications that said, I worked at this building for this many years, I worked on this floor for this many years, and if each day I was at work, I'd use a bathroom on the floor this many times a day.
Would that have been sufficient? Take for example what came out at the deposition about the period of time being, say, 6 to 12 months.
At that point in time, it may have been enough. It's hard for me to say, but they didn't offer any of that.
Was there any indication on the record that depositions were yet to be scheduled following up on the chief? Was at the time of this summary judgment, was the plaintiff saying, wait a second, discovery is near complete, I have to depose A, B, C, and D?
Again, unfortunately, I was not present at the time of that motion.
Well, have you
but the summary judgment was three. Yeah. The summary judgment 3 years after the complaint was filed.
Yes, yes. I have looked at the transcript, but I don't remember if that was a question that was raised. But I do know that 3 years in time is enough to come up with a certification that has been suggested here today to indicate the frequency of bathroom use. How long someone had worked there in order to support a claim at 51% has been suggested here to overcome summary judgment at that time. The judge, I do know the judge in his transcript said, well, I have nothing here. And if you can't show me, because I have nothing else here, if you can't show me that you're on the camera, summary judgment is going to be entered.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's going to take a recess.